But whether they got an answer?
True,
Isabel agreed. At any rate, if she had a reference letter, I didn't see it. Shall I get some more biscuits? Oh! Daisy was dismayed to find crumbs on her saucer, and the nearby plate empty. I honestly didn't mean to eat any. No, please don't fetch more. But I'd love another cup, thanks. I wonder whether Sally would know whether her aunt had a reference letter. Ask her. I'd better not. I'll mention it to Alec, though. I can't see why Mrs. Hedger would have kept it if it was bad, or why she wouldn't have shown it to me if it was good. Good in parts, perhaps, like the curate's egg. She'd prefer not to show it if you didn't demand it, but as you didn't, she probably has thrown it out by now. More than likely. You know, I can't help feeling Mrs. Gray must have gone to France. Otherwise, why hasn't anyone found her handbag? And even if she sent her trunks ahead, she must have had overnight things. A small suitcase, at least. Mustn't she? You'd think so. I couldn't have helped noticing if they were anywhere in the house. I even went up to the attics. There were some things she sold us that we didn't really need, just cluttering up the place, so I stored them up there. So she must have taken her bag and a suitcase. Where are they? They could have been dumped anywhere, Daisy protested, and the police have had only 2 days. They can't go off hunting in all directions for something that may be in Paris, or at the bottom of a pond somewhere, not until they have much more information to go on. I suppose not. All the same, I wonder whether they've checked at the station here. Mrs. Gray might have left something in the left luggage office, though they'd surely have reported it to the police by now. If she forwarded her trunks, though, they'd probably remember where to. Wouldn't Mr. Underwood or Alec have checked that? They might not have thought of it. Men seem to be able to manage with a tenth of the luggage. You could go and ask at the station, couldn't you? In theory, but Alec and the inspector would probably be furious. No need for them to know, unless you found out something useful. And then they ought to be grateful. Ought to be. Alec is seldom as grateful as I feel he ought to be. Still, if it weren't raining, I'd be tempted. Isabel glanced at the window. It stopped raining, and I have shopping to do, as well as the post office. I hate to turn you out. In fact, you're welcome to stay put. But I'd like to go before it starts pouring again. I'm coming. I just can't resist inquiring at the station, now that I've thought of it. It's a great trial, being subject to insatiable curiosity. Like the elephant's child. I loved the just-so stories when I was little. She sighed. I always thought someday I'd read them to my children. Oh, well. What can't be cured must be endured. I'll just take the tea things to the kitchen and wash up later. Daisy's thoughts turned from Mrs. Gray's luggage to Isabel and Inspector Underwood. She was pretty sure they had taken to each other. The trouble was, supposing their liking became friendship, grew warmer, and ended in marriage. What would happen to the amicable household of the three women? Not to mention that, although she had somehow gathered the impression that Underwood was a bachelor, she didn't actually know whether or not he already had a wife. Alec would say,
"Don't interfere."
And this time, he was probably right. Carrying umbrellas, Daisy and Isabel walked down Orchard Road and crossed Station Road to the post office. Isabel went in. Daisy went on towards the station. At the near end of the bridge, over the railway cutting, she stood aside to let a couple of women with shopping baskets go by in the opposite direction. The footway on the bridge was so narrow, pedestrians could pass each other only with difficulty. Once the way was clear, she crossed the bridge and had just reached the far end when she heard hurried footsteps following her. She glanced round and saw Isabel, practically running after her and about to call out. With a wave, Daisy turned right and moved a few feet down the slope to the station, where the pavement was wider. Isabel caught up. She clutched Daisy's arm with one hand, the other flapping an envelope with a foreign stamp.
"From France!
Gosh! From Mrs. Gray? Hold it still, do. I can't read it."
"No, to Mrs. Gray."
Isabel handed it to Daisy.
"I can't make out the postmark. Can you?"
Daisy peered at the blurry impression. "Saint-Tropez, I think. It's taken a long time to get here. It's dated the 5th.
The post office has held it for a week, expecting her to write with a forwarding address. They should have given it to the police, shouldn't they?"
"Yes, but never mind. You can hand it over in person to the inspector."
Or you could give it to Alec.
He'd be bound to think there was something fishy about my having it. Better that it go straight from your hand to Mr. Underwood's. I'll go to the police station with you, if you like. But first, I want to ask about her luggage."
"All right. I'll come too."
Isabel tucked the letter into her string bag, and they set off down the hill.
"The station master is in charge of left luggage, and he knows me from when I was constantly dashing back and forth to Wickham. I bet he knows I bought the Gray's house, so he won't be surprised if I ask about her trunks.
Whereas if I do, he'll either guess that I'm just being nosy, or assume the police sent me to ask, if he knows about Alec, which could lead to trouble when he finds out they didn't." Isabel grinned.
"It sounds as if you're often in trouble with the police."
"Only because they regard any attempt to help as interference. I don't know why I bother."
"Insatiable curiosity.
There's the station master now, looking portentously at his watch. Must be a train due." The burly man in the smart uniform frowned at his gold pocket watch and peered down the line towards High Wycombe. The wail of a whistle came to Daisy's ears. The station master's frown vanished. He stowed away his watch and prepared to welcome the up train to his station. Daisy and Isabel waited until the train had made its brief stop, allowing two women, laden with loot from the Wickham shops, to alight. As the station master turned back towards his lair, Isabel accosted him.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Jenkins."
"Afternoon, miss. Something I can do for you?"
"I hope so. I'm Miss Sutcliffe. I dare say you heard I bought Mrs. Gray's house recently."
"That I did," he responded cautiously. "And I heard Mrs. Gray was foully done to death in that same house."
Isabel turned to Daisy.
"Is it all right if I explain?"
"You'll be Mrs. Scotland Yard?" asked the station master.
"I am. I'll tell you what happened, if you promise not to pass it on."
"I won't. The company don't put gossips in charge of stations. We see things, and we hear things, and we keep our mouths shut. Not like the county police. That's Sergeant Harris. He's in a mint of trouble, on account of not holding his gab."
"So I believe." Daisy wanted to give him as little information as was necessary to persuade him to help. "The thing is, The death occurred before Miss Sutcliffe and her friends moved in. The body was in the cellar, and they didn't have a key. Because it's been several weeks, it's not easy to identify, so the police are not absolutely certain it's Mrs. Gray.
Is that so? I'd recognize her, surely. Always popping up to town, she was. Come through this very station, 4 or 5 times a week, sometimes.
Do you think you would? Of course, you'd be willing to try, a responsible person like you. Shall I mention it to the inspector? Best to keep Alec out of it as much as possible, though his profession had given her a chance with Mr. Jenkins.
Happy to help, madam. I wouldn't put myself forward, but if they was to request, I wouldn't say no. Now, what is it I can do for Miss Sutcliffe?
Isabel retrieved the letter from her shopping bag. I just picked this up at the post office. It's addressed to Mrs. Gray. It ought to be sent on to her, if she's alive, or returned to the sender with an explanation if not. But there's no return address on the envelope.
I'm sure you'd have told the police if she'd left any bags with you.
I would, natural.
I wondered, though, whether she forwarded a trunk from here, and if so, whether you remember the address it was sent to.
There was 3.
Mr. Jenkins visibly went through an internal debate.
Reckon it can't hurt to tell you ladies. Not that I remember the addresses, mind, just the towns. She sent 2 trunks to some place in France, with a saint's name. Not one of our English saints. I suppose the frogs have their own saints.
A saint on the Riviera? Saint-Tropez? Daisy asked.
Like that, but with a Z on the end. Tropez, he buzzed. That's it. What the street was, I can't tell you, after all this time. 6 weeks, must be, or more. The company'd have records, though.
I hadn't thought of that. Of course they would, in case the trunks didn't arrive, or were damaged in transit. The station master nodded sagely.
Happens. T'other trunk, that one, went to Paris, a fortnight or so later.
No. What was the hotel? A king. Not a name. Something like His Majesty. The Majestic?
That's it. If there's nothing else I can help you with, the down train is due in 2 minutes.
Daisy left it to Isabel to thank him, as another layer of protection against being accused of interfering. They left the station and trudged up the hill. "If you don't mind," said Daisy, "would you tell Mr. Underwood you made inquiries with the intention of readdressing the envelope, then realize that it ought to be turned over to him right away, and leave me out of it?"
"If that's what you want, they should be pleased, shouldn't they? They can get in touch with the hotel. If Mrs. Gray never turned up, she must be dead."
Not necessarily, but it would be another nail in her coffin, so to speak. I wonder what the letter says. I expect it's from the friend she was going to stay with, asking why she hasn't arrived yet.
More than likely. It's a pity we haven't got a full address. There must be millions of English people in Saint-Tropez.
Well, dozens. Probably hundreds. But Alec says the French police are far more efficient, or fussy, if you prefer, about keeping track of who's where, especially when foreigners are concerned. With the name, they'll be able to find her if they need to. Drizzle started falling again as they walked up the curving lane towards the old town. Daisy opened her telephone box red umbrella, and Isabel, her conventional black. It was only about a mile, and after the steep slope up from the station, It wasn't much of a hill. But Daisy began to flag. She still hadn't regained all her strength after her illness. They crossed London End to the Saracen's Head and went on past the hotel along Windsor End. Just before they reached the police station, Isabel stopped suddenly. "What on earth are they doing?" she exclaimed, staring across the road.
"What? Where?"
"Oh, good gracious, I didn't spot them." In the graveyard, half visible through the rain, Alec, Underwood and Ernie Piper stood among the trees and tombstones. They appeared to be solemnly discussing one of the stone memorials.
"Daisy, could they be going to exhume Mr. Gray?"
"Is that his tombstone?"
"I have no idea."
"I doubt it. They can't prosecute a dead person.
The school's just behind those yews, isn't it? What do you bet they're going after Cartwright?"
26. Running footsteps on gravel. Alec swung round to see a small boy in grey shorts and a green blazer, without his cap. Satchel in hand, he dashed along the path from the school towards the street. With his free hand, he seemed to be rubbing away tears. One of his dark grey knee socks had sagged down to his ankle, and on the skinny calf, two dark red wheels were clearly visible. Alec decided he was going to enjoy confronting Cartwright. Pennycook emerged from the shrubbery.
"That's the last of 'em, sir. Poor little blighter."
He aimed the announcement halfway between Alec and Underwood, uncertain to whom he was meant to report.
"Let's go."
The inspector took the lead. Alec glanced back to see if anyone had observed them. On the far side of the street, flaunted a bright red umbrella. He sighed. Still, Daisy was preferable to a crowd of curious locals. The sound of four determined men tramping along the gravel path was very different from a scared schoolchild fleeing. Intimidating, Alec thought with pleasure. He reminded himself that they had no first-hand evidence against the schoolmaster, nothing to justify a charge of indecent assault, far less one of murder. An alarmed face peered out through the schoolroom window, then disappeared. Leaving Pennycook outside to ward off interruptions, Underwood marched straight in without knocking. Cartwright had his back to the door, standing at the blackboard, cleaning it with a feverish motion. He turned slowly, trying to look surprised.
"To what do I owe the visit, gentlemen?"
His voice quavered.
"Acting on information received, sir," said Underwood, at his most stolid. "And pursuant to our inquiries regarding the death of Judith Gray, widow of Albert Gray of Cherry..."
"I know where the bloody woman lives. Lived."
"Bloody?"
Alec repeated.
"You disliked her?"
"I hardly knew her,"
Cartwright said sullenly.
"Hardly?"
asked Underwood.
"I suppose we may have spoken once or twice, at a dinner party, or some such occasion."
"It strikes me as a bit odd that you know her address, if you'd only met once or twice, casually."
"Someone must have mentioned it in my hearing. I have an excellent memory."
"Good. Good."
Underwood rubbed his hands together.
"Nothing better than a witness with an excellent memory. Don't you agree, Chief Inspector? You'll have no difficulty then, Mr. Cartwright, remembering whether you've ever been to Cherry Trees."
"Niff! I... Possibly."
From adamant to peevish, in 2.5 words. In my position in the community, I and my wife receive many invitations. I can't be expected to remember everyone who's asked us over for drinks before dinner.
In spite of your excellent memory. Ah, well, perhaps Mrs. Cartwright will be able to tell us.
And now he was alarmed.
There's no need to bring my wife into this.
This?
This nonsense. Insinuating that I was involved with Judith. With Mrs. Gray. Why would a smart, well-off young widow like that want anything to do with the likes of me? A penniless schoolmaster with no prospects and 20 years her elder. But she married a man 30 years her elder and more.
Now he was disgruntled.
Judith.
Eyebrows raised, Underwood let the name hang in the air. The silence stretched for all of 20 seconds that must have seemed an age to Cartwright. He capitulated.
All right. I admit I called at Cherry Trees, just to offer neighbourly condolences. Mrs. Gray was very friendly, invited me in, offered a drink. She asked me to call her by her Christian name.
She was friendly, so you called again?
Only once or twice.
Mrs. Gray was friendly still, perhaps a little flirtatious?
The sort of manner more appropriate to her gay circle of London friends, perhaps. She led me on.
You tried to kiss her. She rebuffed you. You quarreled and...
No, it's not true.
You didn't try to kiss her.
No, of course not. I'm a married man with a position to uphold.
You weren't considering that,
said Alec,
when you made advances to the others.
Cartwright moistened his lips.
What do you mean?
With distaste, Underwood told him.
Three young women have affirmed that you attempted to fondle them against their will.
Liars! They're all the same!
Relying, no doubt, on your position to give you greater credibility than them. However, they're unknown to each other, and they all tell the same story.
The schoolmaster sank onto the tall stool behind his lectern desk. His voice failed him.
You must realize,
said Alec,
we can't ignore the possibility of your having behaved in the same way with the murder victim.
I didn't kill her.
We'd like you to come across to the station.
People will see. The rector...
The rector already knows about those three incidents.
Cartwright buried his face in his hands.
Here comes Vera, said Isabel.
Vera scurried across the street, almost running.
Your umbrella caught my eye, Daisy.
She was very pale.
Oh, it's awful. Alec and his sergeant and Inspector Underwood marched into the junior's classroom. Are they going to arrest Mr. Cartwright?
I doubt it, said Daisy, unless they've uncovered something I don't know about, which, of course, they may have. Come on back to the Saracen and have a cup of tea. We've had ours, but you look as if you need it.
Don't let his fate worry you, Vera.
Isabel patted her friend's arm. If he's arrested, it's no more than he deserves. Go and order tea, and I'll join you in a minute. I just have to deliver this letter to the police station.
I wouldn't if I were you, Daisy advised. We know none of our lot are there, and for all we know, Harris is back. I wouldn't trust him not to lose it, or even open it.
That's the point. All right, I'll come with you two.
They all started walking towards the hotel. I mustn't stay for another cup of tea, though, if I'm to get the shopping done.
We can go home, Vera. The cellar's been cleaned thoroughly, and Mr. Underwood says we're allowed to move back in.
Thank goodness. I can't wait to be back in my own room. I'll pack up all our stuff.
I haven't told them yet that we're leaving. I hope they won't charge us for tonight.
I'll sort that out for you, Daisy offered.
Thanks. They won't want to offend you in case you move out too.
Would you mind taking charge of this letter as well? I'd like to go straight home with the shopping, and you can give it to Alec. Yes, but I think we ought to give each other proper receipts for it.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't want Alec to think I somehow wangled it out of you, or worse, the post office. And you'll want something saying I've accepted responsibility for handing it over to the coppers.
What letter?
Vera, her woes forgotten, was bursting with curiosity. Isabel quickly explained as they entered the hotel. The lobby was empty. Vera, foregoing the cup of tea she had needed so badly a minute ago, made for the stairs.
Tea at home. Bliss.
Daisy went to the reception desk, where she found a pad of paper and a pen stand. She and Isabel each wrote out a suitable receipt, then signed and swapped them.
You go and do your shopping. I'll sort things out with Mr. Whitford. Don't worry. I'll make sure he doesn't charge you for tonight.
I don't know what we'd do without you, Daisy.
Oh, nonsense. You'd manage. Just a minute. I keep forgetting to ask you. No, never mind. It'd be better if Willie's there. I'll drop round later, if that's all right.
Of course. Any time.
Daisy tracked the landlord to his den. He grumbled a bit at her request, but soon let himself be persuaded, as long as the ladies cleared the room before 6 o'clock. That gave them plenty of time, but Daisy went up to see if Vera needed any help.
No, thanks. We have hardly anything here. That's what has made it so difficult. We'd have had to start washing things in the hand basin and hoping they'd dry overnight. Daisy, how much tip should we leave? It's been so long since I stayed in a hotel. I've no idea what's proper.
This weighty question was settled at 20% plus sixpence for the boots, and a bit extra for Sally, because she's been so helpful.
Do you have enough cash? Plenty for the tip, and my checkbook was in my handbag, the one that Pennycook brought, thank goodness.
Vera sat down suddenly on the nearest bed.
It's all very well, but what about Mr. Cartwright? What are they saying to him? Are they asking him about me? What will he say about me?
Vera, honestly, you have no need to worry. The rector is on your side, and he heard what those others said about Cartwright.
But he, or the school board, may decide it's easier just to get rid of another infants teacher.
They'd never find a man to teach the infants, so they'd just put themselves in the same situation all over again.
At least, they can't be sure he'd be chastened enough not to repeat his offence.
They could find an older woman.
I'll be very surprised if they don't give him the sack. He ought to go and teach in a boys' school, where there are no young women to tempt him. If, that is, he's not arrested for murder.
Do you think that's why they descended on him?
I'm sure of it. I'm afraid the police wouldn't think what he did to you and the others a serious matter if it weren't for the possibility he tried the same ploy on Mrs. Gray. I wish I could hear what they're saying, and what he's saying.
Vera shuddered.
I don't.
She got up and closed the one small suitcase Pennycook had brought them from Cherry Trees. It had so little inside, it didn't need sitting on, as Daisy's suitcases almost invariably did. Musing on Mrs. Gray's missing suitcase, Daisy retired to her room for a nap.
27. Cartwright didn't resist being taken to the police station. Finding out that the rector knew of his misdeeds took the stuffing out of him. Even his moustache looked limp. He forgot to take his overcoat and hat from their hook as they passed. Ernie Piper retrieved the hat and plonked it on his head, then helped him into his coat. The schoolmaster had wit enough left to jerk down the hat brim to shadow his face. To Alec's relief, Daisy's umbrella was no longer visible. In fact, no one was about except a constable trudging away towards the crossroads, presumably on his beat. Pennycook bringing up the rear, the five men crossed Wickham End and entered the station. Cartwright stumbled on a step. Ernie caught his arm and steadied him. Sergeant Harris was at the entrance desk. He looked up, glared at Alec, and without a word started to write busily. Underwood ignored him. They went through to the office. The inspector motioned Cartwright to a chair. He sat down as if his knees had given way.
"I'll be with you in a moment, sir. Chief Inspector, I'd like a quick word."
Leaving Ernie and Pennycook to loom over the schoolmaster, Underwood and Alec stepped out of the room. Closing the door, Underwood nodded gloomily towards the front of the building.
"I'm sorry he's back. We needn't expect any more cooperation from him than is necessary to keep his nose clean."
"No, I'm afraid not. With luck, we won't need much from him. Piper and your chap are good men."
And then there was Tom, busy behind the scenes.
"Pennycook's still wet behind the ears, but he tries. Quite quick on the uptake. I was thinking someone ought to catch Mrs. Cartwright while we've got hubby here."
"And you're wondering whether Piper could handle it? I take it you're not ready to stick Cartwright in a cell to cool his heels."
"No, and nowhere near ready to arrest him."
"I'm glad we agree. Ernie could handle it, but on the whole, I'd rather you or I did."
"You. We've already impressed him with your rank."
"Oh, is that my function?"
Underwood laughed.
"Among others. Pity to waste it. Do you want to take Piper?"
"I'll leave him for you. Better just one person for the first interview, especially with a woman."
"Do you want to take your wife to hold her hand?"
"I think I'll manage without,"
Alec retorted, grinning. The inspector nodded.
"Right. You know where they live?"
"Ernie found the address among your reports and told me how to get there. That's the sort of detail he excels at. It's just 5 minutes' walk."
"Don't forget we have an appointment with the Vaughns at 6, and you offered to drive."
"I'll be back."
The Cartwrights lived in a small, newish house of the local brick. The small front garden with its white picket fence was very neat, the lawn closely mowed and dandelion-free, the two beds well weeded and still colourful, boasting chrysanthemums, Michaelmas daisies, and a couple of rose bushes bearing a few late blooms. On one side of the house, a hawthorn flaunted its crimson berries. A flock of chattering chaffinches were busy wrecking the display. A net curtain twitched as Alec opened the gate and set foot on the crazy paving path. Peripheral vision informed him of twitching curtains in the houses on either side. If a canvas of the neighbourhood should prove necessary, it would be much more fruitful than the struggle to elicit information from the residents of Orchard Road. He rang the bell. Had Alec been asked beforehand what he expected of Mrs. Cartwright, he'd have described her almost to a T. She was about her husband's age,
possibly a year or two older. Her brown hair was set in overstiff, marcelled waves, and her makeup was minimal. Her maroon woolen afternoon dress was of good material, well cut, but not in the current style, nor that of the past couple of years. Alec was conscious of fashion, because clothes tell a good deal about character and circumstances. Her face was set as stiffly as her hair, in lines of discontent. Her look was hostile.
If you're selling Hoovers, I already have one.
She started to close the door. Alec was tempted to offer her the latest model, but he curbed his tongue.
I'm a police officer, madam.
The hostility remained, but she said grudgingly,
What do you want?
A few minutes of your time.
He glanced to left and right.
Perhaps I could come in.
If you must.
She stood aside and shut the door emphatically behind him, as if defying her neighbours.
Well, what is it?
Could we sit down, do you think?
Her mouth tightened, but she led the way into a very conventional sitting room. The furniture well chosen, though inexpensive. Over the mantelpiece hung an oil painting of a colourful garden. Alec went to take a closer look.
I wish I had more time to spend on my garden,
he said, and turned in time to catch an almost wistful expression.
It's a lot of work. If I had time and money, I'd have a big garden and help. And if wishes were horses, beggars would ride.
Impatiently, she added,
What is it you want to say to me?
He introduced himself.
Scotland Yard.
She raised plucked eyebrows.
Indeed. To what do I owe the honour of your call? Do get on with it. I have to go and supervise in the kitchen. The girl simply can't do anything right.
Alec decided he had to crack her shell of indifference if he was to get anywhere.
I must inform you that your husband is presently helping my colleague with his inquiries at the police station.
She paled beneath the rouge, and she sat down at last, but her voice remained indifferent.
Sit down, Chief Inspector. I don't like people towering over me. What has Roger done now? Set his heart on some underage enchantress? Not one of his pupils, I trust.
You're aware of his straying?
Obviously. Don't tell me he's gone beyond making overtures this time.
She took a cigarette from a silver-plated case, the silver worn to show the brass beneath, and tapped it on the lid before lighting it with a match.
We're investigating.
He makes us both ridiculous, she snapped,
driven at last to overt anger, viciously stabbing out the cigarette after one puff.
Please tell me how he came to be a church school teacher.
I can't imagine what that has to do with anything. But if you want, he was a promising young barrister when I married him. He was in first-rate chambers, a criminal practice. He'd recognize the name, I dare say, and he bore out the promise until the war came along. When he was demobbed, he just couldn't settle back into his work.
Not uncommon.
Which made it no easier to deal with.
No. I beg your pardon.
Alec noted her self-satisfied look. Scoring a point off the questioner made people feel superior and, oddly enough, sometimes caused them to open up.
Please continue.
In the end, he resigned from his chambers. Our savings ran out, and we went to live with, and on, my parents. He found work occasionally, but never stayed long. If he didn't quit, he was given the sack.
Was there a pattern? I mean...
I know what you mean. He usually quit because he considered the work meaningless, or demeaning, or both. He was dismissed sometimes for drinking, usually for losing his temper once too often.
He has a bad temper.
He flies off the handle at the least little thing.
And lashes out?
Sometimes. Mrs. Cartwright regained a measure of caution. Not with me. Not since I fended him off with a hot poker. This isn't anything to do with his philandering, is it? You think he killed that woman? What's her name? Gray?
Did you know he was interested in her?
I'm not saying another word.
Do you want to ring up your lawyer?
My lawyer? On a schoolmaster's salary, one doesn't have a lawyer at one's beck and call. Alec didn't press her. He was inclined to feel sorry for her, particularly as her husband was almost certain to lose yet another job. On the other hand, he wasn't convinced that she hadn't known about Judith Gray. Given that knowledge, she herself might have been tempted to push the woman downstairs, with or without the aid of a hot poker. Though, as far as Alec knew, she hadn't attacked any of Cartwright's previous amours. Everyone had a breaking point. The female of the species. In less than 2 decades, Kipling's line had become a cliché. Alec's years of policing, not to mention the war, had taught him otherwise. The male human was far more deadly than the female. But one must not discount the female. What of Mrs. Vaughan? Walking back to the police station through the damp dusk, he called to mind what he knew of her. She was the one who had brought money to the marriage, according to Willie Chandler's boss, Davis, who had it from his partner, Myra Vaughan's brother. Her income was sufficient to run a car. The money was under her own control, and she wasn't particularly generous with it, as evidenced by her lending the car to her husband. Her stinginess might be responsible for his holding a job, though possibly her income was insufficient to keep them both in comfort, or perhaps he just enjoyed the work. His employer said he was good at it. Yet to all appearances, what he earned from commissions didn't satisfy him. He was fiddling the books. Had Judith Gray found out? Was Vaughan himself aware of the audit? Back at the station, he rejoined the others. As he entered the room, Cartwright looked round apprehensively. He was seated facing the desk. Pennycook stood behind him, and Ernie, notebook and pencil in hand, sat against the wall. Underwood, behind the desk, stood up.
"Might I have a word with you outside, sir?"
To Ernie Piper and Pennycook, he said,
"Keep an eye on him."
In the corridor, the door closed, Alec said,
"I take it that was a rhetorical warning. He hasn't tried to leave, or turned obstreperous, has he?"
"No. He seems pretty cowed. He's admitted to having kissed those 3 schoolmistresses, against their will. But unless they decided to bring charges, we can't do a thing."
"And they won't?"
"No. That sort of trick calls for a sock on the jaw. But Miss Leighton has no one entitled to administer it. Superfluous women, my arse. If you'll pardon the expression. Sniggers in the press, and wanting to send them to the colonies. They're victims, like the boys who should have lived to marry them. Aren't they?"
"Not quite as final,"
Alec said mildly.
"What else did Cartwright have to say?"
"He repeated that they led him on, and all he wanted was a bit of affection. Pathetic, really. His wife sounds like a right..."
"I wouldn't be too quick to judge. A question of the chicken and the egg. Anything more?
Not much. He still denies having anything to do with Judith Gray beyond a call of condolence. That would be more credible if he was a clergyman, or if he hadn't referred to her as Judith.
And if he hadn't the history with the other women. Possible witnesses to his visiting her would be Mrs. Hedger, or her niece, or Vaughan. Vaughan can't deny having been in the house himself, whether his calls were all business or not.
Or Miss Sutcliffe, Underwood reminded Alec. She was in and out of the place while deciding whether to buy it, and then going over the inventory with Mrs. Gray, though I would have expected her to mention it to me if she'd seen Cartwright there.
Not necessarily, given Miss Layton's emotional reactions to his name. Now that we've cleared that up, though, you can ask her.
The inspector looked a little self-conscious.
I will. I don't know how much point there is in asking the charwoman, though. Might as well talk to a brick wall, from what you and Miss Sutcliffe say.
If Sally Hedger hasn't seen Cartwright there herself, she may be able to get an answer from her aunt.
D.I. Piper can talk to Miss Hedger, said Underwood, getting a little of his own back. Now, what's this about chickens and eggs?
Alec told him what Mrs. Cartwright had related of her husband's sorry history.
So impossible to tell who was reacting to whom, but I'm inclined to blame the wreck of their marriage on the war.
Very likely. Not that we need to worry about that, only about the effects. But it's time we were off to see the Vaughans. They live out in Hazelmere. We'd better get moving. I'll have to let Cartwright go.
Underwood sighed. Cartwright warned that if he left Beaconsfield, he must provide an address where he could be found, scuttled out. Pennycook was left holding the fort. The other three detectives walked to Alex Austin 12. On the way, seeing the schoolmaster dive into the Saracen's Head, doubtless to find a meagre solace in alcohol. Alec drove, with Underwood beside him, and Ernie Piper behind, leaning forward to offer directions. He had, as a matter of course, studied the appropriate map. Though the hedged lanes wound hither and thither and crossed each other at frequent intervals, without benefit of fingerposts, Ernie was never at a loss. They reached Hazelmere. They found the correct street. It was less a street than another lane winding downhill. Turning into it, Alec could see lights indicating several large houses at considerable intervals, set well back from the road. "And now numbers," Ernie said apologetically. "It's a dead end with a manor at the end."
"I imagine the lord of the manor sold off the land for building," said Alec. "Sorry, Ernie. You're going to have to hop out every time we come to a gate."
Ernie had to hop only twice. Most of the gateways had signs readable from the car, set where headlights illuminated them as they crawled by. The Vaughan's Manor Lodge was the last on the left. Its position close to the lane, with a minuscule front garden, suggested it had, in fact, been the manor's lodge. Alec turned into the drive, which led along the side of the house to a wooden garage at the rear. The old house was built of brick and flint, two stories with low ceilings. No lights showed in the front or side windows. Only a dim light bulb over the front door.
"Damn it," said Underwood. "I left a message with his boss, and both message and note with the secretary. Pennycook rang here and left a message with a servant."
He checked the luminous dial of his watch.
"It's past 6. Don't tell me he's done a flit."
"Ernie, Go and check round the back.
Piper returned after just a minute. Just one light on. I think it's the kitchen. It has a window at the back and door onto the drive. There's a new wing back there, but it's completely dark. At the far end, it has French doors to the garden. Underwood marched ahead to the front door and rang the electric bell. After what seemed a long wait, he rang again and knocked as well. This time, the fanlight above the door lit up. The door opened on the chain. A youthful face, half excited, half apprehensive, appeared in the gap.
You the police?
Yes, miss. Detective Inspector Underwood. I have an appointment with Mr. and Mrs. Vaughan.
They ain't aren't here. Mrs. Walker, that's the housekeeper, said to tell you they've gone off to London. London.
With an obvious effort, Underwood said pleasantly,
Then we'll just have to have a word with you and Mrs. Walker.
And Mr. Grissom, too. Dilly's ain't, isn't here. She went to the pictures with her young man.
And Mr. Grissom, too. Open the door. There's a good girl.
I'll have to ask.
Very proper. You go ahead and ask.
The next face to appear was male, elderly, and truculent.
Where's your helmets? That's what I want to know.
The inspector explained that they were detectives who seldom wore uniform. When Grissom closed the door to take off the chain, Underwood said quickly,
If we can separate them without making it too obvious, will you take the housekeeper, sir? Sergeant, the girl for you, and I'll tackle this fellow.
He stopped the manservant in the tiny entrance hall to ask a question. Alec and Ernie followed the sound of female voices to the kitchen. Here, they were in luck, as Mrs. Walker promptly sent the girl to the scullery to peel potatoes for their supper, whither Ernie unobtrusively slipped out to join her, leaving Alec with the stout housekeeper. The kitchen smelled of roasting mutton. A vivid flash of olfactory memory took Alec back to the smell of roasting beef in Isabel's kitchen and the revolting sequel. Banishing it, he introduced himself.
You can't blame me, said Mrs. Walker.
Alec raised his eyebrows. Elucidation followed.
I told the mistress myself I did. Dillis, she's parlour maid, she took the telephone call as is her duty, and she told me, and I told the mistress. The police are coming to see you and the master. I said. They rang up on the telephone, I said, and made an appointment for 6 o'clock this very evening. And you know what she said? We're going to the theatre in London. That's what. And it's no use arguing with the mistress.
Difficult, is she?
Alec sympathised. Mrs. Walker considered this proposition.
Not difficult, I wouldn't say. It's just her growing up in the manor till her pa died. She knows times has changed, but she don't rightly feel it inside her, if you know what I mean.
I know just what you mean, and that's very neatly put, if I may say so.
Tom would be proud of him, he thought, as she preened.
I don't mind. Would you like a cup of tea?
That's very kind of you, but not just now, thank you.
I'll put on the kettle, in case you change your mind.
She lit the gas burner under the kettle.
Yes, off to the theatre they went, the both of them. Though I did ought to tell you, as the master thought they ought to stay home. Leastwise, that's what he said, but it don't always do to take what he says for gospel.
No. For instance?
Like the manor, for instance. It's let to an American,
a millionaire. The master handles the rent and such, him being in the business. Now, maybe he's counting on how the gentry don't talk about money, what they've got and what they spend. But these here Americans seems like they never stop talking about money. My friend, Mrs. Golightly, which she don't, being a large woman, she's housekeeper over to the manor, and she heard them arguing over could they get a better house for the same rent. One of them mentioned the amount, and Mrs. Golightly just happened to mention it to me. And I just happened to notice, doing the household accounts like I do, the mistress not being brought up to it, I just happened to notice that what she's getting isn't what they're paying. She ended with a sort of triumphant gasp, having run out of air.
Mr. Vaughan, as agent, is entitled to a commission, you know.
I know that. It's written down as is right and proper. But it don't add up right, and that I'd swear to.
Did you tell Mrs. Vaughan?
I did not, not being one to come between husband and wife. I lost my own in the war. I'm not saying he didn't have his fault, same as anyone, but...
Underwood's entrance saved Alec from a recital of the late Mr. Walker's desirable qualities. Though he had intended to broach the subject of marital infidelity, he judged that Mrs. Walker would not take such a question kindly, so the interruption was not unwelcome. Mrs. Walker went to the scullery door.
"Not finished them taters yet, my girl. This rate we'll be eating at midnight."
"They're all done, Mrs. Walker."
The maid appeared with empty hands, followed by Ernie, gallantly carrying the heavy cast-iron saucepan for her. Grissom had likewise followed Underwood into the kitchen. The inspector addressed Mrs. Walker.
"You'll excuse me, madam, if Mr. Fletcher has already asked, but can you tell me what time Mr. and Mrs. Vaughan are expected back?"
The housekeeper shook her head regretfully.
"The mistress said not to wait up. It's her first night, seemingly. Why, she was so keen not to miss it. There'll be a party afterwards. They won't be home till well after midnight."
28. When Daisy lay down for her nap, she didn't fall asleep, but she grew so somnolent that a very soft tapping on the door startled her.
"Who's there?"
"It's me, Sally, Mrs. Fletcher. Come in. What time is it?"
"Just after 6, madam. I hope I didn't wake you."
"I was just resting my feet. It's been over an hour. Today seems to have lasted a very long time already. What is it?"
"There's 2 messages come, madam, that I thought might be urgent."
She came over to the bed and handed Daisy a pinky buff telegram envelope and a double folded note on lined paper.
"The telegram's for Mr. Fletcher, sent over from the post office. The boy said it's from Scotland Yard. I told him to take it to the police station, but he said it's addressed to the Saracen's Head, and that's where he was told to take it."
Holding up the telegram to the light, Daisy wished she could see what Crane had to say. It must be from him, though she knew she had no hope of reading it. She could, however, deliver it to Alec herself. If she sent Edward the Boots to deliver it to the police station, the same difficulty applied as with the letter from France. If Alec was not there, both might get into the wrong hands.
"I'll see he gets it, Sally."
She laid down the telegram and picked up the note.
"Constable Pennycook brought that one, madam. The telegram came just after he went off, so I couldn't give it to him."
"This is from Alec." She recognized his handwriting.
Let me see what he says. She untucked and unfolded the paper. Oh, bother. He won't be back for dinner. I don't suppose D.C. Pennicott mentioned whether they're all at the station,